Good morning on Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. This is Brian Madden, and you're listening to our BrianMadden.com live podcast. I'm sitting in my apartment in San Francisco. Joining us from the studio in San Francisco via Skype is Jack Madden. How are you, Jack?
I'm good. Good morning.
Gabe is here from his home in Omaha, Nebraska.
That's right. Hello, everyone.
And our guest today is Tim Mangan, joining us from what I can assume is the greater Boston area.
Right. Good morning.
So, we've done. Thank you for joining us today, Tim. For those listening, there's a chat room, so go ahead and send questions if you want. We don't have any specific agenda or topics for today. We'll talk about just news and what's going on in the industry and what Tim has been up to. Tim, I think you are, something about App V, so we can talk about that. But the first thing I want to address, and I don't want to be, perceived as like attack journalism or anything, but Tim Mangan, do you or do you not have a beard at this moment?
I do have a beard at this moment.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay. I mean, when I first met you, you had a beard. And then you didn't have a beard for a while. And as far as I'm concerned, when I first met you, you had a beard, so you should have a beard forever.
my wife and my children seem to feel that way, too.
Oh,
that's
good.
Why it's back.
Yeah.
You didn't match your bobblehead. I mean, that was the biggest thing for me.
Yeah, so, we had Ron Oglesby last week on the show, and both Tim and Ron were both speakers. There were two of the five speakers who spoke at the first 10 Bri forums, like 10 for 10, without missing one. And so as a gift of gratitude, we gave them a bobblehead that looks like themselves.
And in the show notes, Tim is still
awesome.
Tim is the lone remaining person on that list that has spoken at every Bri forum besides Brian himself.
Is that
really?
Didn't Jeroen also?
No, Jeroen has taken. He's been off.
Oh yeah, and I know Ron hasn't, and I know Benny hasn't. Yeah,
yeah. And if Jeroen has somehow snuck by that, that ends at London because he is going on vacation. I think he's touring Asia.
Yeah, for like 3 months.
Yeah.
So if I want the record, I need to get a hitman.
Yeah, but then it's hard to call it Bri Forum. Then we'd have to call it Tim Forum.
Tim Forum. But that's good, though. Tim, you have, TM, Tim Mangan, that's a good. You've got TM Urgent, you've got TM Blog. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a catchy kind of thing. So, like, TM Forum, I feel like that would work fine.
I don't think I'm quite the outspoken person that you are.
Yeah, but the hitman, that's no problem. Like, I'm not going to make, a fool of myself. I'll let someone else do that. Thank you. Tim, one of the things we've been doing, and there's a lot of stuff I want to sort of ask you about what's going on, in our industry and just kind of stuff that you're seeing. But the past couple of weeks, what's been kind of fun is we sort of started talking to folks about kind of how they got into IT in the first place. And you are someone who I don't remember meeting. So it's like how you don't remember meeting, your family. Like, I feel like I've known you forever, mm-hmm. so I don't know. I mean, it's been 15.
We met at the Elephant and Castle in Boston.
Okay.
You were up doing a training class.
Okay, and that's going to be 2004, possibly?
Yeah, maybe.
More than 10 years, let's
more
say.
More than 10 years, yeah.
Well, definitely. I guess we've had Bri Forum for 10 years, and you've been in all those. So, and I remember, I think at the time I was asking about how you got involved in IT, and it had something to do with ISDN. Is that right?
So your memory is Tim
quite.
Going, wah, 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 ISDN.
No, I really spent the first 20 years of my career as a software developer in a variety of places, mostly the communication industry, doing a lot of boxes that people would use to get stuff to talk to other stuff. And it was Softricity that really got me a little bit more into this space after we built the product. And then I left and I ended up doing Originally some products, and now I pretty much am doing training consulting for IT folks.
And you got, because so you were at Softricity. I mean, do I have to say this now? I mean, it's been long enough. It might actually be worth saying. Like, did you know, listeners who have not been in this industry for a decade, that Microsoft bought AppV from a company called Softricity, in the Boston-based company? And Tim, you worked there in those days, sort of before Microsoft bought them.
Oh yeah, way before. Yeah, we actually started out as another company called Software Wow. If you recall,
I recall you wearing a polo shirt that said that to a Bryform old T-shirt contest, I think, one time.
Yep.
Do you have a polo? Do you or do you not have a polo shirt that says Software Wow?
I don't think I have one anymore.
Oh wow.
But that was because I remember the time Software Wow was weren't you involved in the Computer History Museum or something? Or?
One of the founders had been working there as a director, and so he and a couple other guys got together and they ended up bringing me in, and you know, Software Wow was this weird. Actually, today I call it the first app store in the cloud. I mean, we didn't have those terms, but that's pretty much what we were doing. We were taking standard off-the-shelf software applications, wrapping them up, and making them available for a web page where you would just click on a link and it would stream down and run on your PC. And when you were done, the software would go away and it wouldn't be ever installed, was the concept.
And that was not done for any kind of enterprise applications management. That was purely...
Oh, it was purely games. I mean, I had a team of six guys who were testers that we quite literally drove around loading docks, rolled down the window and said, hey, how'd you like a job work for minimum wage where all you do is play games all day long? You know, somebody had to get to level 23 of Doom and made sure it still worked.
But that was it, though, right? So like this is because this is late 90s, 2000 time frame, right?
Yeah. End of 99 and early 2000.
And so, this is the days, you know, the internet, the web was starting to be a thing, not a lot of broadband.
The average customer was coming in on a 300 baud modem. 9600 was really good in 1999.
So, this was where you were, you know, so you click on a link, and obviously you can't wait for the whole 10 megabyte Doom file to download. So you just put a little bit. So all the Software Wow technology was what did the streaming. And I think you did the isolation and virtualization back then too, just to make it so that the stream package would actually run on whatever.
Oh, heck no.
They had. No?
No, that was the thing we didn't have. We literally brought the stuff down. Although we were using streaming to, speed up the process, you really had to get the whole thing down there and before you started running. And we basically were just faking the installation. You know, the stuff came down, we had a script that populated stuff in the registry, and then stuff ran. And when you shut the game down, another script ran that cleaned all that stuff out. I mean, we broke an awful lot of PCs.
So what happened with Software Wow? Like, how did it get from Software Wow into, Softricity and like turning the corner into the enterprise?
Yeah, well, that was the whole marketing side of the thing. We picked a sales model that just didn't work. It was way too early in the game. It was all built around the Wow player, which displayed web banner ads while you were playing the game. And when we designed the system, those things were brand new, and the competition was radio and, you know, television ads, newspaper ads. So they were paying us 5 cents to display a banner ad for 30 seconds. And so, you know, if you were going to play a game for several hours, we'd start collecting some revenue that way. Yeah. Well, by the time we got out of beta, they were down to 2 cents, and they were telling us that in another year, they expected that they'd only pay us if someone clicked on the banner ad and went to the web page.
And you were like, no.
That was game over. You know, no one's going to do that.
Yeah, because we knew it didn't work at all.
Yeah, so we had to find something else to do, and we took some of the lessons we learned and then built an enterprise solution. Originally, the target market was the ASPs, who were all using Citrix MetaFrame in those days.
Mm-hmm. And that was so same kind of reasons for them, I guess, right? Is that they could just have the applications. Well, I guess the same thing we talked about today.
Well, for them, it was the application conflict issue, and that's where we had the virtualization. So, yeah. You know, the ability, the biggest problem, you know, if you were trying to get up a massive, RDS, or that terminal services website or site, you know, you put on 190 applications, you go to install the 191st, it's not enough to just install it and test that app. You had to go back and retest the other 190 apps to make sure that they all still worked, because you had no idea what would break. And so that's where the virtualization came into play and really made their life so much easier, that they could just bring the app in. They knew it couldn't conflict with anything else, and they could save all of that effort.
I guess in those days, those were the big Citrix shops. Right? Like, it wasn't, you know, in the early days, it wasn't, you know, enterprises didn't have these massive Citrix installations or anything like that. It was these ASPs. And then, of course, as the ASP model kind of died and the enterprise model sort of picked up, I mean, a lot of people were doing this in the enterprise. Then from the Softricity standpoint, you got a lot of Citrix servers? Great. We don't care who, you know, what kind of company you are.
Yep, exactly. And that's where we went. And, you know, originally it was those really large companies that had those size of farms and wanted to do farm consolidation. So those were the target customers.
But then you were at Softricity in the early days, and you went, when you left Softricity, you went right into doing what you're doing now, right?
Sort of. No, not really. I really went out and decided I wanted to build another product. But I didn't want to do it right away. I wanted to spend a year to 2 years just doing basic IT consulting and understand what customers really need. And then I'd go build something.
Had you ever done that before, or was your whole life spent as a developer?
My whole life had been as a developer. I'd never even considered going working for myself before I left Softricity. So it was a big step for me. And the third day I was home, I got a call from someone who had been a Softricity customer. Says, "Hey, I'm having this problem, and I heard, you know, you weren't doing anything, and maybe you could help us with this." And they were having a problem where they were using terminal services, and they were a small end ASP, and they'd taken on a customer, and the customer was just finished onboarding. They got them up and running, and the very first day, it turns out that the first user ate up a complete system. And, you know, they figured they were going to get like five
Welcome
people.
Welcome to Citrix Town.
Yeah, been there.
Exactly. So I looked at what the problem was. And it turned out it was an old DOS application. And when you had a DOS application running, the NTVDM would eat up a complete CPU. And so, you know, the user came on and, you know, it was only a two-processor system. I mean, this was a big end system, you know, in 2003. Boom, you know, second user got on and that thing was flooded. No one could even log in anymore. So I ended up developing a product that I ended up marketing, because I found out there was a bunch of people with this kind of problem. It was called TMU Limit. And it basically did a quality of service, you know, clamping down on these applications so that they couldn't eat up too much CPU. And it developed and sold that around the world for a number of years, and eventually sold that to Triceret. And then it's included in their product suite, the Simplify Monitoring, I think it was the last name I remember. I don't even know if they still sell it.
Simplify. It's just, I think, called Simplify. But so you, though, literally had this idea. I mean, you know, you're working at, you know, as a developer, and thought, okay, I'll spend a few years just in consulting, that kind of stuff. And it was 3 days on the couch before someone called you, and then all of a sudden you're back in it.
Yep.
Yeah. So that shows. So anyone who's not sure about whether they should quit their job and follow their dreams, do it, because you'll only be on the couch for 3 days.
Well, that was
my... it took a very supportive wife.
But it just goes to show, like, you can't get away from this stuff once it gets into you, I guess. I mean, that was my story. Was I started doing desktops, and I worked my butt off to get to be a server admin. And then the very day that I started being a server consultant, I met Brian. Brian said, I'm going out to this hospital to do a pilot for this thing called MetaFrame, and you want to come along? And then, bam, I got right back into supporting desktops. Like, you just – apparently once you get the smell on you, you can't get it off.
Yeah, but when you're doing Citrix desktops, you still have the capability to break a lot of them very, very quickly. So you really do have the server – the power of a server admin. You can ruin a lot of people's days with one click.
Right, thus creating job security for yourself as you fix them one at a time.
And failing that, you just bring a virus into the office.
Been there too, my friend.
So Tim, but most of your, because the days of you know, the TMU limit and that kind of stuff. I mean, this is 10 years ago, I think also.
Mm-hmm.
And so first of all, let's talk about TMU limit. You know, so Citrix bought a company called Arima, which had a similar-ish maybe product. 10 years ago, I think they kind of went out of business,
yeah,
and Citrix picked them up. AppSense had something like that. You know, TMU limit, and I think you were doing process prioritization, right? Not
right.
Clamping of CPU. You were actually changing the priorities of processes.
There was a little bit of both, but it was primarily around the earlier, and the prioritization, and that's where my patent really came into play.
Whoa! You have a patent?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Oh yeah. I got it.
How do you do that?
It turned out not to be anywhere near as hard as I thought.
What?
I mean, this is like
a Monty Python sketch. Wait, you have a patent? Oh yeah, no, it wasn't. Well, not hard. It didn't take that long.
No, it cost me like $200. I wrote up, you know, a 20-page document and sent it in, and they approved it.
Did you have like a patent person or call 1-800-PATENTS or whatever? Or it's just...
No, I just did it myself.
Oh, be darned. Oh, wow, that's awesome. Do you know the patent number?
Not offhand, no.
I didn't know if that was like a tattoo or something like that.
If you Google searched me in the patent office there in the United States, you'd find it.
Man, my question before I was fawning on the patent thing does all this, like the CPU prioritization and everything, like I think, you know, Windows Server has some of this now built in, at least when you're using RDSH, and I wonder, like, is this still a thing that people need nowadays, or is Windows just better now and it's okay?
Well, first of all, we got rid of NTVDM because we're dealing really with 64-bit machines for the most part. And those old DOS apps, nobody has those things around anymore. So, you know, the biggest problem area is gone. Windows Server does have a little bit. I mean, they used to have WSRM, and they abandoned that because it really didn't work very well. For all of the reasons of my patent, because they took the wrong approach. And now both they and what Citrix does is more session-based. So it takes the entire CPU of a user's session and prioritizes that, make sure that overall user session isn't using too much CPU. That's a little bit different from what I was doing, which was per process. But quite frankly, we've got so many more processors on the boxes. CPU is probably the last problem you should ever have anymore.
And so the and I guess, you know, you've done a lot of sort of sessions. As I asked, as I'm sort of reminded, you know, you did a book, what was this, 2-3 years ago? It was called something about, like, Windows...
Oh, caching in Windows 7. Yeah,
yeah,
performance,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Caching in Windows 7. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've been, and that book, that was, it's, so I've explained this book to people before, where I believe it's kind of like Stephen Hawking, if you read, maybe not so much A Brief History of Time, but like A Universe in a Nutshell, for example. And as you read it, it makes total sense. You understand everything, and you're like, yeah, that's how it is.
Are you claiming to be the one person who read that book?
Hey, I noticed, despite the several... You try to throw us off by changing fonts, changing changing headers and everything, and I stuck through it. But the thing is, it makes sense when you're reading it, you know? And then someone else later on's like, oh, well, what'd you learn? Well, you know, I mean,
how
Windows.
Have you used what you learned?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a, well, first of all, I mean, obviously, we're reminded of this every day that Windows is complex. but I kind of forgot about that until just now. Yeah, now I should go back and read that. But I mean, you know, you've been in this space, you know, because I kind of forgot. Like, you've been in the space of sort of Windows performance, which we didn't really care too much about before Citrix and VDI, and now we're putting lots of users on, you know, consolidating them and everything. And I guess there still is a lot there. I mean, there's still, you know, that's still a hot topic people talk about at conferences and in the forums and stuff. It's about, you know, VDI density and performance and all that kind of stuff.
But I don't remember talking about performance back then anyway as much as we do now. I mean, you know, I guess either it just was what it was or we were just not aware of how good it could be, you know, back in the late 90s. It just was there. This is the performance. There's nothing better. There's nothing, you know, we could get you a slower computer. Yeah. And so it really took, because even then, all these things were new to us too, all these concepts of you know, like caching. And so we didn't know what we were doing either. We just, you know, you want faster? Okay, we'll get you some more memory or another CPU, that sort of a thing. And back in the time, we could actually just change the CPU. And so, you know, now we just know so much more.
There were a ton of tricks that everybody was using, though. If you remember those massive
overclocking
lists of registry hacks to do to your Citrix server. I mean,
And I think that was the start of it, because that was, you know, once Windows 95 came out, we were content to just get that going. And then now, all of a sudden, now we learn how to tweak it, and we can make it do different things. And then that grew and became, you know, more and more people read the resource kit, and then everybody became experts, whether or not they deserved it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. You're right. You are absolutely right. More and more people read the resource kit, and then everyone became experts.
Huh? Well, no. I say experts.
That is 100%. I know what you mean. They became experts. Just ask them, because that was the forum threads of those days, was like about, you know, oh, my users are slow, and it's like, did you turn on this registry key? Because if not, you're an idiot. And like, it's like as if any of that worked. Here, let's ask Tim, because it's like, do you honestly believe that Microsoft or Citrix, the, you know, billions of dollars companies would have a product that, oh yeah, by the way, it sucks unless you set this registry key to 7, and then it's amazing. Like, would they really sell the product that works that way?
Unfortunately, they do.
Okay. Well, so here's the next thing besides people being experts.
I owe a lot of apologies to people in the forums.
We must believe Tim Mangan, because he has a PhD.
And a patent.
Well, I got a patent anyway.
Yeah, no, that's the other thing. Right, because for some reason, I introduced you as like Dr. Tim Mangan, I don't know for how many years. And you're like, dude, I seriously don't have a PhD. I don't know where that came from. I'm like, are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
but what is – so on this whole, like, you know, performance tuning stuff, is there anything – I don't know if this is – do you do this kind of work now? Are you getting into, you know, figuring out why people's systems are slow, or are you mostly working with AppView nowadays?
I'm mostly working with broken applications. It's really not the performance stuff. It's you know, how to try to get the stuff out there and working and deployed and what's happening with those.
So let's ask. So broken applications. What do you mean? Like, how is it that applications, like, if you have a broken application, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, a while back, I mean, it was a lot of the just the plain DLL hell. You know, you get an application that would change out a shared DLL at some other application depended on, and it would just break it. We see very, very little of that today. Most of the problems that I run into today are related to the way the applications try to integrate with each other. And so it's a lot of problems with COM and problems with in essence, in the end, permissions in terms of, you know, what can talk to what And as we try to virtualize them, of course, sometimes we make things a little worse because we're putting additional layers in the way that can cause additional problems, and we're trying to figure out how to work around those.
And when you say virtualize, you mean like an app V or something like that? So you don't mean that
like an app V, but yeah, quite frankly, you see it in any of the guys that are doing the layering as well. You know, they're also putting barriers in that sometimes will cause problems.
And I guess at the end of the day, that's just if the application is being used in a way that was not sort of the exact way that the writers of the application intended, really all bets are off then, with what might
happen. Exactly. Yeah, you're always going to cause some type of problem. And so that's been a big part of my focus, particularly, I'd say, in the last 6 to 9 months, has been really looking and trying to understand how the applications have these interfaces and how we can discover them and figure out where things need to work together.
So give me some free consulting. So you spent the last 6 to 9 months focusing just on that.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about that? Like, if you're going to kind of summarize like everything you learned the last six months.
In two words, easy. Applications suck.
Oh, that's a tweet. Okay. Volley, applications suck.
First, everybody.
Response, agreed. Volley, so what do we do about it?
Good question. So when I say applications suck, I mean, what I've found is that, you know, over the years, Microsoft has provided so many different ways for applications to work with the operating system. And, you know, as the operating system evolves, they add more and more. And developers find creative ways to get the applications to integrate and work together. And what we have at this point is this humongous mess. And quite frankly, I don't see a solution for it other than, in essence, eventually replacing the platform, you know, and that may be, that might mean the cloud or whatever, but I think at this, we're getting to a point where the Microsoft operating system is so complex, it's just hard to keep the whole thing up and running and efficient to support this humongous legacy of applications. I mean, you can still run everything other than the old 16-bit DOS programs on today's platforms. And they're still pretty much going to work as long as you only have that one app.
There was a really cool video a few years ago showing the evolution of Windows. And I think they installed, like, DOS 3 and then Windows, like, you know, 2 or whatever, the very before Windows 3.0 and then 3.1. And then kept on upgrading from there on out up through, I think they skipped Windows ME, but they got everything else up through Windows 7. And there was still some menu settings that had remained in effect over the entire course of Windows. And there was still an application that they installed at the very beginning that still worked in Windows 7. And the video is really cool because that just illustrated that they built in, you know, 25 years or whatever of backwards compatibility. And I can't imagine what a pain in the neck that is to regression test, you know, every time they do a release. I mean, I'm sure it's not accidental that it still supports that application. I think it's doing it on purpose. And that
accidental,
so Windows
luck.
You're saying apps suck, but really it's because Windows is the way it is, applications have to suck.
Yep.
Man.
I agree 100%.
Here, I just posted that, so now we can all watch that. Yeah, because that's still today. So even as Microsoft, you know, went to whatever they're called now, Windows 8 apps or Windows
Universal apps.
Universal. You know, there's still the old system is still there. So in some ways, all this does is it doesn't fix anything. It just throws another type of application into the mix without really getting rid of anything else. And
well, the Universal apps actually have a possibility of helping to solve the problem. The issue right now that I see with the Universal apps is that they're all these little isolated islands, and they take the opposite approach in that the applications don't integrate at all. You know, you run this one app and it does its thing, and the best you can hope for is it, you know, drops out a data file that you can pull into another app. But for the most part, you know, these things don't work together at all. And that helps solve some of the complexities, but it makes those applications far less useful.
Yeah. This is like our, you know, of course you can, of course non-persistent desktops are excellent because you can lock them down, take away the user's admin rights, not allow them to install any applications. But they're not secure because you went to VDI. They're secure because you locked them down and took away their access to install applications. And that's, yeah, okay, great. These apps are awesome, but...
No conflicts. No, there's no more application integration conflicts. Fine print. The applications are not allowed to integrate with each other. So,
well, look at the way that iOS has been going with adding the story of the last 7 years of iOS has been adding more and more app to app integration.
And
oh yeah,
oh,
and it's becoming a full fledged OS with all the complexities that are associated with that.
And version. And version conflicts and stuff. So now there's apps for iOS that are not upgraded and they just don't work anymore. Like you can't use, you know, there's certain apps you just can't use because that if an app maker stops supporting their app and stops upgrading it, then it just doesn't work. I guess. So, but on the Windows side of things, like I want to come back to this, you know, so the Microsoft sort of desktop computing environment is just, you know, it's like the sort of Winchester mystery house. You know, this just kept on being added on to and built on sort of forever without any sort of centralized master plan.
Because the ghosts would take it over if they stopped.
Yeah, yeah. The ghost will kill her when she stops building. So just don't stop building. And it's fine. Which actually maybe is kind of the case with
That's
Microsoft.
What I mean.
Too. Oh, you were talking about Microsoft. You weren't talking about...
No. Ballmer and Gates were mystics.
But yeah, so I guess, well, what has to happen in the future and all that kind of stuff, I guess that's interesting trivia, but really doesn't matter to sort of rank and file. You know, you're responsible for your applications and your desktops, and you're just kind of dealing with life. So in the meantime, so Tim, you learned that, you know, applications suck, and this whole thing may break at some point and may have to be fundamentally changed. But until then, so I got Windows 7, and I've got it deployed out to, you know, a few thousand users. You know, what am I doing? Am I using AppV? I mean, is AppV a thing? People use Microsoft bought AppV. Microsoft bought Softricity. They renamed it AppV. They made it sort of free with SA, let's call it. And,
sure. Yep.
And now it's out there. People use it, I guess, yeah?
Oh, quite a bit. I mean, anything that's a large enterprise is almost definitely using it. They may not be using it quite to the same extent that those who were using it were doing it 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, you know, I was talking to customers and their goal was to get, you know, 100% of their applications or as close as they could get to it onto AppV. You know, and we had cases like I remember there was a guy from one of the hospitals out in the Midwest that spoke at a Bryfor. And he explained how he had gotten up to 97% of his applications running under AppV. Now, that guy was an extreme case. Mm-hmm. You know, he had one hammer and everything looked like a nail to him. Mm-hmm. And he would spend as much time as it took to get to that point because you can't get all of the applications running under AppV. But, you know, he really worked at it and he was able to get to that point. Today, I don't see customers doing that. They've got lots of choices. Yeah, they're not trying to. They got lots of choices of way to deploy things. And so you use AppV where it makes sense, and then you use other methods. You know, a lot of those same larger enterprises are using SCCM, and they're going to push things out through SCCM, or they're doing image management and, you know, baking them into the base image.
Well, that's what I was going to ask because – I'm sorry, go on.
Okay. But I think what you need, though, is you need to have that flexibility to be able to quickly add things in, to isolate off where you need to. I mean, every large company has problems of Java conflict, if nothing else, you know, and image management and layering isn't going to solve the problem of an end user that needs two different versions of Java for two different tasks that they have to do, one to do their timesheets, one to get their health benefits.
I'm laughing because that's like I love the practical real world examples, and you just actually literally said what my exact problem is. Wow. So that's creepy. So backing up, like AMP-V, so it sounds like there's a sweet spot, because if an application is sort of like just works perfectly and is very well behaved and just installs like click, click, done, you don't need AMP-V. Like, why bother?
And as long as you're talking persistent desktops, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, on the other end of things, you know, if an application just doesn't want to work with AMP-V, I mean, how much effort are you really going to spend on shoving one application into AMP-V if it doesn't work with it, you know, to save you what? If you could just bake into the image or just deploy it manually sort of with SCCM or something like that. So imagine there's like a sweet spot of applications where AMP-V makes sense.
There is, although actually, you know, sort of funny. I ran into a customer last summer who was in one of our training classes, and they don't have SCCM. They have Big Fix.
Ooh, remember them? So,
yeah, remember them? Yeah, apparently IBM owns them these days. Yeah. And, you know, they felt about Big Fix the way I hear most IT people feel about SCCM. In other words, they really don't like it, but they have it, and that's what they use. And as they went through the training, one of the nice things with AMP-V is we now finally got system-level scripting so that we can publish an application to the user and we can have it run a script that runs under the system context so that we can do things like install device drivers and stuff like that that we can't virtualize. These folks took a look at it and said, hey, wait a minute. I can just create dummy AMP-V packages and use that for deployment of 100% of my applications by just throwing them in these scripts. And I can get rid of Big Fix. So I don't know if they actually followed up on that, but they definitely left the class thinking, yes, this is the way we're going to go.
Oh.
And is, do you endorse that practice?
Well, so, with AMP-V, I was going to ask, you know, so there's, you know, AMP-V now is in version 5, and that's just since Microsoft had it, right? Like there's versions, or do they start with version 3? I don't remember, but I mean, so it's getting better and better and better. So like what, because you mentioned like device drivers, you know, that was a big thing for years and years. If you had device drivers, it just wasn't going to be packageable with AMP-V, but it sounds like that's solved now.
Well, it's solved in that you would typically package the GUI portion and then bring along the installer for the device driver and just make that part of the script. So you have one way to push the whole thing out now. That's the advantage. AMP-V, what Microsoft did is they actually took everything that we originally wrote and threw it away and rewrote it. They went through this 3-year period. And what they did in essence, if you think about the older version of AMP-V, AMP-V 4.6 and below, we tried to virtualize everything possible. In other words, everything for that application was contained and not visible outside of its bubble, with the exception of shortcuts and file associations. And occasionally we'd push out some COM objects to get some interactivity in between applications. But that was it. Everything else was fully isolated. The whole design goal in 5.0 was to basically take that bubble and make it look like Swiss cheese and identify about a dozen different types of interactions and allow those things to get outside the bubble. So in addition to a lot of the COM stuff, now we can let items such as some of the events get out. We can let the virtual services get seen as we need to. And there are other things like app paths and just newer technology that's needed for the integrations that Microsoft has added for the developers over time that just weren't available in the past. And so now we're isolating a lot less than we used to, and it's opened up the door to let more applications come in. And, of course, it's also made things a little more complicated for certain applications. So we're adjusting as we go along on there. But ultimately, I think the approach of having more transparency and more integration with the operating system does make a lot of sense. And it's really the future where application virtualization is going.
Like, why do you think that AMP-V is a standalone product? Or why wouldn't they just build this sort of make it, I don't know, a feature, or like a better word, for part of Windows?
Why isn't it part of the operating system? We ask them that every time the MVPs meet with them. We say, why don't you just make it part of the OS?
Yeah.
And I don't really, I mean, in essence, it is part of the OS for remote desktop, right? I mean, that is totally free. It's just part of your RDS license.
Yeah.
You need to get into there anyway. You know, they have this MDOT program to provide a number of technologies, and they seem to feel that that's a value add. Quite honestly, I think that they certainly don't want consumers going near AppV.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it certainly is an enterprise thing.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that might be the big deciding factor of why it never gets into the OS.
So the evolution, though, I mean, AppV 5 has been around about a year or so, hasn't it?
No, it was released 3 years ago in November, and it sucked. It wasn't ready.
Oh, okay. I really swear that was last year.
Well, no, last year is when you wrote AppV 5 is out, right? But then you should stick with 4.5 because it's more stable.
Yeah. Let me tell you this story. So, you know, I'm a Microsoft MVP, so we get to see stuff early, right? So I started seeing the first parts of AppV 5 about 9 months before it got released. And they had worked on it for almost 3 years without really talking to anybody outside about what they were doing. We had no idea that they were working on it. So we went through this testing process. They went and they had a public beta. And at that point, they were releasing on schedule with System Center. So they were doing annual releases in the January to February timeframe. We had a meeting with them, with the developers. We just brought in kind of like an MVP summit, but it was a mini one for just the AppV guys in Boston, and met with the developer team in September. And at that time, the beta had been out, and we sat down, and the first thing they said is, okay, I want everyone to go around the room and say what they hope to accomplish here in our meetings in the next 2 days. And I started things off. And I said, okay, I'm here for one big thing. I think you're on target. You never tell us when you're going to release, but I'm guessing you're planning to release this in about 6 months in the January, February timeframe. And I'm here to try to convince you that it's not ready and you should give it another 6 months. So we finished going around the room. And the Microsoft guy stands up and says, okay, I got the first announcement for the day. We completed the build. It's in the can, and it's going to be released November 1st, which is 2 months away.
Right, right. So this is they're releasing it 3 months earlier than what you said they should do 6 months later then.
Exactly. And you know, it took another year for them to get to the point, which was Service Pack 2. That we started to feel it's, for some people, it's okay, and this is time to be moving. And other people should be looking at their applications and starting the process. We felt that there were a few more things that were needed in terms of performance and some things that, you know, they should wait a little bit. But, you know, we really got there roughly last summer, I'd say September, October type of time frame. Is when we knew the product was really rock solid and it was time to move.
And so now you feel good about that for AppV 5 Service Pack 3.
Right.
That's the way to go.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm seeing a lot of people. The other thing we have going on now is we've kind of got finally the point of getting near the end of life for the 4.6 product. So there's a lot of customers who are still running the 4.6. And at the end of maintenance is coming up here in June. And, you know, Microsoft's not going to be fixing that product going on. So, you know, what I'm seeing in my classes now is, you know, people coming in who have 4.6 and they're finally ready to be making that move over. And they're trying to get that done as quickly as possible. Although it's not quite the kind of rush it was with the end of life for Windows XP. I mean, it's not... AppV is not a target for people writing viruses, so they're not quite as worried about that. But, you know, they know they want to get off of it and get moved over.
So what's this AppV Manage tool? This is a thing that you wrote, right?
It's probably one of the worst named tools I've ever written. It has nothing to do with management at all.
Okay, so this is, to be clear, we're talking about AppV Manage.
Yeah, it's called App VManaged. So this is a free tool that I have that pretty much everybody uses right after they've finished preparing the application for virtualization. So they go through a process. It's called sequencing. It's a repackaging type of process, gets it into an App V package, and then they need to test it. And so this is a tool that helps them with the process of testing that app for the first time, figuring out what's wrong and getting that fixed and get through that process a little more quickly.
And this is so. And this is a tool. It's on your blog, which is TM Urgent, or TM Urgent. I think you pronounce it as.
I usually say TM Urgent, but if I'm trying to get someone to figure out how to spell it, we do then say TM Urgent.
TM Urgent. We'll put it in the notes. But this is one of the tools that you wrote yourself that you make available for free to help people, with their testing and stuff.
I should say now it's mostly free. So last week I released a module for it. One of the things I wanted to do was to produce some paper documentation that I'd gotten a request for from customers. They wanted to be able to document what was in their software package. And so it goes through and it documents all of these external interfaces in terms of what's in the package and what isn't. And it just generates this Word document. And so I'm actually charging for that. Because I know there are a lot of third-party packagers that the companies go to that are just going to take that and deliver that as documentation now. And I figure if they're going to charge the customer for it, I should get a little something.
Yeah, that seems fair. You've had lots of tools over the years. Is there other stuff that's people are sort of actively using now?
The other major tool people are using right now would be the AVSS package, which is an alternate way to deploy the AppV packages. So forget SCCM, forget the AppV server. You just basically use Active Directory and a file share, and it'll get the packages out to the users. People are using this mostly in a VDI type of scenario, where you just want to have less overhead and less servers involved with the process.
And you know the desktops and everything's in the same network and everything. That way it works nicely.
Yep.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit. I mean, so are you, like, your typical day, you're giving training classes and seminars about AppV. You're doing consulting, I guess, that people have. They just want strategy around AppV or building packages, you know, helping them with their problem packages, that kind of stuff. That's all stuff that you're doing.
I wouldn't call that my typical day, but yeah, that's all stuff I'm doing. I mean, my typical day, quite frankly, is I'm playing around with software applications and continuing to try to learn more about them and how they're constructed and where things break down. So, you know, finding examples from customers that say, hey, you know, we're having some weird problems with AutoCAD and sort of try to figure out what's going on there. I probably do around 8 to 10 weeks of training classes a year. When the weather isn't like it is now, I play a lot of golf.
It's 75 and sunny here. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm looking at snow still, so.
I've sort of made these big declarations in the past few months around application compatibility and non-persistent images. And I basically want to ask you, as like an AppV guy, and I mean that like not pejoratively, if I sound like what do you think of what I'm saying, right? So this is one of those annoying questions that you get at conferences where someone basically makes a statement and then is like, what do you think about that? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put be right up front. I'm going to do that. So
you're like Larry King, react.
One of the problems with non-persistent images, the whole non-persistent VDI vision, one of the biggest showstoppers for me of why non-persistent doesn't work everywhere is because obviously all of our, you know, if all of our users have non-persistent images, we still have to get all the apps into our users' desktops. And so, you know, if they all have the same applications, that's fine. We install them all in the base image. But there's this idea that, oh, well, you know, you use AppV to package all your apps and, like, stream them in kind of on demand into this non-persistent image. but that works great, except that AMP V doesn't work with all of our applications. So it's either a combination of like some using AMP V, some in the base image, but what if you don't want it for every user, but it doesn't work with AMP V? It just seemed to me like a big nightmare. And now we're getting a lot of other companies out there, like Unidesk with sort of VDI and well, Unidesk and virtual environments only, Liquidware Labs, Cloud Volumes, now to App Volumes, FS Logix, who are doing, it's not full on application packaging and virtualization, but it's sort of the more of like app management, app enabling or disabling or layering or whatever you want to call this. And they have a lot more sort of higher levels of compatibility than AMP V. And I think some of these are not, it's not these versus AMP V, because they themselves will say, yeah, use us for the applications, yeah, you know, for the 95% of your apps, then the ones that conflict or badly behaved, you wrap those in AMP V and all that kind of thing. But is that something that is enabling people to use non-persistent desktops where you can get closer to, you know, sort of 100% compatibility? Like, are these technologies complementary? Do you, you know, see these going away and as AMP V gets more flexible, or I don't know, just...
No, I think we really need a combination of those technologies. I mean, I remember doing a blog post on your site a number of years ago where I had this kind of Chinese menu thing where, you know, if you think of AMP V as being doing kind of a slicing, and you could view vertically, you know, and then the layering guys are kind of doing these horizontal slices. And, you know, just the whole layer cake thing, you know, one piece on another. And you really end up needing a combination of those, because not all the apps are going to work together. You know, you take any image or layering solution, you still have to worry about the apps that don't work well together. And you still have those same costs of getting the apps onto those images. Ultimately, what you see enterprises do is they're going through an MSI repackaging operation. You know, the installers you get from the vendors are horrible. And they will repackage those into their own MSIs that can be silent installs that can then go into these images. And the amount of effort it takes to do that versus the amount of effort to virtualize an app through AMP V is typically greater. In other words, we actually save time by virtualizing those apps that virtualize easily. And that's one of the hidden costs that are in there. And that ultimately, I think, you know, what the customer wants is a combination of those things. And I think actually the customer wants also bring in someone like Bromium, you know, some of their concepts. They're not necessarily into the right market space here, but the whole idea that just like we had originally an operating system, which was single user, and the user had the rights to do pretty much anything, and then we separated out the user and kernel mode so that we could kind of protect the operating system from the user. And we bring in multiple users and have this session-based thing so that one user can't affect another. We really want to end up in a spot where an application can't affect not only the operating system, but can't affect other applications. And we really want to get these things better isolated. But to do that, we really have to do a better job of understanding what the interfaces between them are, and provide better mechanisms and a more controlled mechanism to make those interactions available. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah.
I was afraid I lost you guys.
No. But so what is the – so I don't know how to ask this. I want to say, so what's the point? So that's the way of – you know, like the theoretical, okay, so here's how it could evolve to be better. Like, how does it actually work out in a practical sense?
Well, in a practical sense right now is I think you're using combinations of those technologies, and you're also combining it very much with the data side of that. So whether you're talking about an AppSense or, you know, some type of user environment management stuff, you know, it's not just the applications that are problems. You've heard me talk about over the years about how, you know, the real problem is the data associated with it, and how do we manage those?
Actually, the data, yeah. What's the you've spoken at Brightform on this in the past, and I think you've written about this on brightmed.com as well. But what is the give us your 30-second, you know, what is the data problem, Tim Mangan?
The problem is that we have these applications and they're generating all this data, and it is completely unmanaged. Even as we start to bring in these other products to help things move along, we still are treating the data in bulk and not really understanding what's in there. So the applications create data that is associated with the user. Sometimes it's associated with the company. The user wants to go from one machine to another, and some of that data should follow them. Some of it shouldn't. If you just look at the Microsoft stacks alone, you've got, I think, 6 or 7 different ways to deal with it. You've got roaming profiles. You've got folder redirection. You've got their UEV product. They've got a disk layering-like solution for the server that you can do with a user disk. I mean, there's just all of these different ways of handling it, and none of them work really well because we don't really have a good grasp on what that data is. And in particular, what I feel the bigger problem that we're right on the verge of is that it's not so much getting the data from one machine to another to follow the user. It's the user trying to use multiple machines at the same time. Mm-hmm. And now what do you do? And nobody has a good solution for that.
And you say that's a problem we're on the verge of. You don't mean we're on the verge of solving. You mean this is the problem that is on the verge of becoming like a problem to a big, big problem.
It's becoming a bigger problem every week as more and more people start using these multiple devices. And there really is nobody out there trying to solve that problem today, as far as I can tell.
And I don't even know what the solution. I mean, because all we have, like, you know, we've got all the Dropbox-like products that can sort of solve this at the file, like file by file level. But now we're getting to the point where you almost need to be able to get into files, which is going to be impossible, I would guess, right?
Yeah, there's some of that. I think a lot of it, a file by file basis would almost be reasonable to start with. I mean, it's not the ultimate solution, but I think it's a good start. But what we don't have is any way to map this user uses this application, and that means these files should go along over and follow them.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah.
And you know, I really kind of view it as that's where it starts. If you could define that, here's an application, here's what should go, here's what shouldn't, that would be great, you know. So we don't really have that. So what are people doing? They're doing things like turning on AppSense for all of their applications and just telling AppSense, hey, I want you to roam everything and make it move over. And then when they have problems, then they go in and they say, okay, I'll turn this off because this caused the problem. And so it's more of a troubleshooting learning method. Now you've met my daughter, Kate, right?
Yeah.
So she was working for me for a while, and now she's working out at a regional bank. And she went there to do AppV, and she's ended up becoming their AppSense expert. And she literally spends 70% of her work time just taking calls from users, figuring out what's broken, turning off the thing in AppSense, and solving the problem.
And now it's
almost a full-time job.
She became the AppSense expert, though, because she works at a big bank, and they thought AppSense, AppV, these are the same, right? You take them.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
And life. So that's interesting. So and your son and does AppV packaging as well, and your wife Mary Jane is sort of involved in business. So it truly is like the family business is about Microsoft's ills to pull our family together.
Yep, that's it.
So what's next? So looking down the road a little bit, I mean, what are you sort of the most excited about over the next, you know, few months, year, whatever, just about anything, you know, technologies coming out, product releases, trends, strategies? Like, is there anything you're really looking forward to in the context of IT, not golf shafts or whatever?
in the context of IT, I continue to be enamored with the cloud and starting to see the pieces coming together that it starts to make a little more sense to start putting some more stuff into the cloud. I spent a lot of time, you know, hearing stuff from Microsoft and all the stuff that they're doing in Azure, and as well as, you know, Citrix's directions from my involvement with those guys. And, you know, I'm starting to see those pieces come together. I think Microsoft is making a huge gamble to try to really think cloud first on everything that they're doing. And ultimately, that could be a problem for some of their existing technologies that they have might get ignored a little bit as they try to push everything to the cloud, particularly if the customers aren't ready to go there yet. But I think we're starting to get a little closer, and I'm trying to spend as much time as I can paying attention to what's going on there.
And then final question. So I know you were in Europe, like, I think just last month, right?
Is that right? Yeah,
touring, speaking. So, but you've spoken to Brian from that kind of stuff. For people listening who want to see you speak, where are you speaking these next, few months, if you want to come see you?
I'm actually in a little bit of a lull right now, but the two Bri forums coming up would be the biggies. I will be at Synergy, and I'm probably participating in the Geek Speak Live. We've got a bunch of balls up in the air right now, so it's not clear whether or not I'll actually be up on a stage there somewhere or not. But I'll certainly be hanging around, and those would be the places to come find me.
And then in the Boston area, there's a whole bunch of user groups that you're...
I've got a meeting just this week on Thursday, the 9th. We have Sean Bass from the VMware Cloud Volumes group coming in and speaking, along with T-Rex from Liquidware Labs.
And that's a public event, like 2 days from now?
Yeah, that's a public event. They can go to www.vertg.com and sign up for the meeting. It's free. We provide pizza. What more could you ask for?
Yeah, it's free and there's pizza there. That's awesome. All right. Well, we are we've actually just gone over our hour. I guess it doesn't really matter exactly how long we go, but I don't know if you have any other final thoughts, but this is awesome. I think we appreciate you catching us up on what's happening in your world, in the world of AV.
No, the only other thing I want to talk about, you just talked about, which was the Vertg meeting coming up. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys. It's always fun.
Yeah, you bet. This is great.
Well, thank you so much. We will see you in Orlando for Synergy, and then the very next week in London for Bri Forum. These are both coming up about a month from now, if you can believe that, maybe 5 weeks. So thank you so much. That's Tim Mangan from Team M Urgent or teamurgent.com. Join us in Boston. Also to Jack in San Francisco and Gabe in Omaha. Thank you guys for chiming in today as well.